Today is October the 24th. Do you know who has your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. WBAI is in a membership drive this evening, and our program has been preempted. Google won't renew its military artificial intelligence contract. Google plans to discontinue a project through which it has been helping the United States military use artificial intelligence to analyze drone footage. The contract is part of a Pentagon effort known as Project Maven. This followed a storm of internal unrest and media controversy over Google's apparent role in weaponizing the use of artificial intelligence. Google has been supplying technology and know-how to the U.S. military for automating the analysis of drone footage. Defense spending is a huge potential market. Many Google employees were objecting that the company might be helping develop technology that could lead to automated drone strikes. The head of Google's cloud business reportedly told staff that the company would not seek a new contract after it expires. Artificial intelligence will be a key asset in warfare going forward, and other big tech companies are pursuing military AI contracts. Project Maven is poised to expand whether or not Google is part of it. While there has been controversy with Project Maven, Google finally confirmed it is building a censored Chinese search engine. It is a secretive project that has been fueling an employee-led backlash at the company. It is a project to build a version of its search engine that complies with China's online censorship regime. The project, codenamed Dragonfly, is not only real, but it's already performing to the satisfaction of top Google execs. And it could pave the way for Google to re-enter China's online search market after nearly a decade. The announcement prompts more questions from U.S. policymakers, some of whom have accused Google of being evasive about Project Dragonfly. Meanwhile, Google and its peers in the tech industry are facing intense scrutiny over its approach to user privacy and data, with some federal lawmakers proposing legislation that could impose new restrictions on tech companies' handling of customer information. Like many other firms, Google is eyeing China as a massive market opportunity. China, which has an estimated population of 1.4 billion, is already heavily dependent on Google's Android operating system. 9 out of 10 smartphones in China are running Android. But Google's position in mobile could eventually erode as Chinese competitors have sought to develop alternatives to Android. Gaining broader access to Chinese audiences could give Google more opportunity to serve online advertising and sell mobile apps. Despite China's long-standing practice of blocking search queries for politically sensitive material such as Tiananmen Square democracy protests of 1989, Google believes it could still do some good for Chinese internet users looking for other information. But the initiative has sparked an internal debate over Google's corporate values that spilt into public view. A leaked letter signed by more than 1,400 employees cited Dragonfly as an alarming departure from Google's normal transparency. Certainly, we do not have the information required to make ethically informed decisions about our work, our projects, and our employment, the letter read. The fact that Google, which famously shut down its mainland Chinese search engine in 2010, rather than continue censoring its results, is willing to push ahead with such a project in the face of a large and, in many ways, understandable ethical backlash, says a lot about how much business values the company sees in having a larger Chinese presence, and that business value might not merely consist of additional revenue that Google stands to obtain, but how having a bigger Chinese presence could make Google more competitive in other markets. Google confirmed the existence of Project Dragonfly, an effort to build a Chinese language search engine that would adhere to Beijing's censorship rules. Though, stating that there's no guarantee that the search engine will ultimately launch, that of course would require a go-ahead not only from Google's leadership, but from Chinese authorities. Google states that they are compelled by their mission to provide information to everyone, and China is 20% of the world's market. Google also claims the search engine could serve well over 99% of the queries it would receive in China, and that it could deliver better information on many subjects. They cite cancer treatment info as one of the many topics. The remarks probably won't do much to calm the backlash the project has yielded since the first reports about it emerged in early August. Even if over 99% of its queries in China wouldn't get censored, one has to think that Google, whose mission statement is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, and until recently had the motto, "Don't be evil," would have to block the search results related to such topics as Tibet, Taiwan, and, of course, Chairman Mao at the behest of the Chinese government. It has been reported that Dragonfly links a user's search to his or her phone number, which would make it easier for the government to track and monitor searches. Nonetheless, senior Google execs clearly aren't backing away from the effort. Their decision undoubtedly has to do with revenue opportunities that would be opened up if Google Search and other popular Google products and services became available in the world's second largest economy. If Google Search is permitted in China, the door would be likely open to various Google offerings to be approved. The list includes everything from Google's Maps, the Play Store, the Google Cloud, Pixel hardware, and Waymo self-driving systems. Google may face stiff competition getting approval for YouTube with its giant library of user-generated content. Nevertheless, launching several or more of these products and services would certainly give Google, whose Chinese revenue for now mostly consists of selling ads to local businesses looking to reach potential overseas customers, a healthy top-line boost, and there are also other business benefits that haven't been discussed as much. China now has over 800 million internet users and nearly as many smartphone users. For a company like Google, which both pays close attention to user data when refining its product and has developed machine learning algorithms that rely heavily on user data to become smarter, getting just a fraction of those consumers to actively use its products would yield plenty of data that Google could use to improve the services it provides in the United States and elsewhere. There are also value for Google in getting hands-on experience running consumer services in an internet smartphone market that's among the most advanced in the world. China's e-commerce and mobile payment penetration rates are well above those of the United States, and the country's tech giants also haven't been slouches when it comes to developing AI-powered consumer services. For all these reasons, Google has strong business incentives to relaunch its consumer services in China, even if domestic criticism of the move remains intense, and perhaps even if the company never directly turns a profit on its Chinese services. Google's CEO says company's protests against the company's work with U.S. military had little impact on management, and he said, "We don't run the company by referendum." Google's motto of "don't be evil" means you don't support the U.S. military with artificial intelligence, but you can comply with China censorship rules for the search engine. I guess they ran this through this line of thought with their artificial intelligence algorithm, and it came out with these results. The Palm Pepito. It's tiny, clever, and for now, exclusive to Verizon. There's a new phone with the word Palm on it, and it's also known as Pepito. It will be available starting in November, but you can't go out and buy it on its own. It's only available as an add-on to a current line from Verizon. The Palm Phone is a device that you can add on to your regular Verizon plan, which shares your phone number. It's a phone designed for you to use if you want to be a little less distracted by your big phone with all its apps. It runs a full version of Android 8.1 and all the apps from the Google Play Store. It could do all the things your big one can do if you want to within the physical limits of the unit. There's a trend of some people trying to get away from being too tied to their phones, while there's also a trend the other way of every phone just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So some are trying to buy a minimalist phone, something that can just call and text, but do you give up on having a smartphone? Do you find that you prefer a dumb phone that does just enough to cover your needs? Chances are there will also be one more thing you want that phone to do. If you want a less distracting phone, what you really want might be something you can use without giving up your big smartphone when you really need it. A minimalist phone for those who don't want a big smartphone. Verizon is selling it as an add-on unit to use when you just want to carry the minimum. The new Palm phone looks nothing so much like a itty-bitty iPhone X. Its design say that they weren't aiming for that. Instead, their design goes of making a little phone that felt comfortable, tucked away in your hand, led to its current shape. Both the front and back are Gorilla Glass 3, and it's rated for water and dust protection. There's just one button, the power button, which serves multiple purposes, and there's only an 800 milliamp hour battery in there. It's a little bit on the small side, but it's a small unit. It's really tiny. It's 50 by 97 millimeters, or 2 inches by 3.3 inches. And it's not much bigger than a credit card, but it's thicker at 7.4 millimeters, which is about a third of an inch. And it weighs 62.5 grams, or only 2.2 ounces. It's easy to believe that you forget this thing was even in your pocket. Being this small, of course, there's no room for a headphone jack or for wireless charging. It has, however, a single USB-C port, and yes, it will be one more thing you have to keep charged every day. It is not a very powerful phone by design, and it has a tiny 3.3-inch LCD display, big enough to use to check information and type on, but not big enough to make you want to do real work on it. The rear camera is 12 megapixels, and there's also an 8-megapixel selfie camera. The Palm phone has a Snapdragon 435 CPU and 3GB of RAM and 32GB of storage. It's on the modest side. Palm has made a bunch of software changes, both to make Android 8.1 work better on a tiny screen. There's a single virtual button on the bottom. You tap it once to go back, twice to go home, and long press it to get the multitasking screen. Since there are no volume buttons, you need to swipe down the quick setting panel to adjust that, and since there's no fingerprint sensor, Palm wrote a custom face unlock feature that uses the 8-megapixel front camera. The power button does double duty as a way to launch Google Assistant. You long press it for that. Instead of the traditional home screen and app-less setup on most Android phones, the Palm phone just has a vertical scroll grid of apps. You long press one of the icons and you get a big pop-up of the shortcut that are available for that app. The Palm phone comes preloaded with a handful of Verizon apps, but not as many as perhaps you might want. Chief among them is Verizon's Message Plus app for texting. It automatically syncs text messages across multiple phones with the same phone number. Verizon's number share feature is the linchpin that makes the Palm phone work, and it becomes an extension device to your main phone. Sharing its phone number, and that's what allows calls and texts to come through. The Palm phone is designed mostly for Android users. iPhone users could use this, but since the Palm phone is an Android phone itself, you won't get their iMessages on this device. It's a phone for people who want having a tiny phone, and that could get you to stop being extremely online. There's a version of this phone for GSM, which means you can buy this phone unlocked for other services, but that will be made available at a later date. For now, Verizon is selling this as part of a package deal, and the price of it is $349. I know it's on the high side, but the GSM version, which was just briefly offered by Walmart, at least that's what I caught, was for $99. Guess what? I can wait. A consumer alert from the Federal Trade Commission. A caller says that he's from the government and your social security number has been suspended. He sounds very professional, so you should do exactly what he says to fix things, right? No, wrong. The FTC has gotten reports about scammers trying to trick people out of their personal information by telling them that they need to reactivate their supposedly suspended social security number. The scammer says the social security number was suspended because of some connection to fraud or other criminal activity. They say the core number to clear it up, where they'll ask you for personal information. Thing is, Social Security's numbers do not get suspended. This is just a variation of a government imposter scam that's after your Social Security number, your bank account number, or other personal information. In this variation of the scheme, the caller pretends to be protecting you from the scam while he's trying to lure you into one. And the FTC gives out the following tips. Never give out or confirm personal information over the phone, via email, or on a website until you checked out whoever is asking for it. Do not trust a name, phone number, or email address just because it seems to be connected with the government. Con artists use official-sounding names and may fake caller's ID or email address information to make you trust them. Besides, the government normally contacts people by postal mail. Contact government agencies directly using telephone numbers and website addresses you know to be legitimate. If someone has tried to steal your personal information by pretending to be from the government, report it immediately to the Federal Trade Commission. Where are we today with autonomous cars? On September the 12th, the National Highway and Transportation Safety Administration released new federal guidelines for automated driving systems, that's ADS. They issue guidelines for best practices for highway safety. On administrative level, states may want to consider new oversight activities on an administrative level to support states' roles and activities as they relate to ADS. Next, application for entities to test ADS on public roadways. For those states with an existing application process for test vehicles, the following are considerations for applications involving testing of an ADS on public roadways. It is recommended that the application for testing remain at the state level. And lastly, permission for entities to test ADS on public roadways. In other words, autonomous cars are still in the testing stages, but control was granted to the states to administer it. Florida is one of those states, and they issue their own administrative rules. One, permits operation of autonomous vehicles on public roads by individuals with a valid driver license. This bill eliminates a requirement that the vehicle operation is being done for testing purposes. Second, eliminates a requirement that a driver is present in the vehicle. And lastly, requires autonomous vehicle meet applicable federal safety standards and regulations. So what happened? The U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration ordered a transit operator in Florida to immediately stop shuttling kids to school in what the agency described as a driverless shuttle and said the company's use of the vehicle as a school bus is unlawful. The letter issued on Friday to Transdev North America directed the transit operator to stop transporting kids in the Southwest Florida community of Babcock Ranch on the company's driverless shuttle. In a press release, NHTSA said the company had received permission to temporarily import the driverless shuttle for testing and demos. Specifically, the NHTSA said that Transdev requested permission to use the shuttle for a demo project, not as a school bus. Transdev failed to disclose or receive approval for this use. School buses are subject to rigorous federal motor vehicle safety standards that take into account the unique purpose of transporting children, a vulnerable population. In late August, the company and Babcock Ranch plainly stated that it would begin operating an autonomous school shuttle in the fall, the first in the world. The 12-person shuttle picked up kids from a designated area, and a safety attendant would always be on board, the statement says. Eventually, school shuttle service will be available to students and parents on demand, door-to-door, using an integrated app on their smartphones. The Florida community started to use the shuttle beyond the scope of the test on public highways. That was a major mistake to include school children in the test. From Dr. Alfred Poor, he's going to be talking about a smartwatch for the elderly for free, and two different approaches to measuring blood pressure without a cuff. I hope you like it.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider. One of the wearable market segments that gets a lot of attention is smartwatches. And now as that market begins to mature, we shouldn't be too surprised to see manufacturers differentiating their products and trying to find a niche for theirs to set them off from the competition. Well, one of the niches that's available is a smartwatch for seniors. There's a lot of things that a wearable can do to help address some of the aging in place issues that the elderly face when they're trying to live independently but safely. There's a new watch on the market that helps address some of these issues. It's called the Nurture Watch, N-U-R-T-U-R-E Watch, Nurture Watch. And one of the things that makes it a little different is that the manufacturer is actually giving away the watch for free. The fine print on that is that the watch is free. It's about a $200 value, but you get it for free if you sign up for a yearly service contract. The reason you need a service contract is because it's actually a cell phone. It has a cell phone service plan, has a SIM card, just like a phone does, and it's able to make and receive phone calls. The thing that makes it targeted for seniors, however, is its feature set. It doesn't have a very complex user interface, which makes it easier to use, and it's got a big red button on the side that when you press it, it automatically calls for help. The design of this looks like a nice smart watch, a reasonable piece of jewelry, and it's a big step forward from the help I've fallen and can't get up pendants that a lot of the personal emergency response services use. Studies have shown over and over again that seniors don't like to wear them or use them, these big pendants. It's sort of a badge of shame that says I can't take care of myself and I need to have this emergency system in case I need help. And the other thing is that people who have these systems even don't press for help when they need it. They're reluctant to do so for a lot of good reasons. The interesting thing about this watch is it doesn't look like one of these personal emergency devices. And another thing about it is that it will automatically detect a fall. If the wearer falls and doesn't respond in a certain amount of time, it will automatically start calling the people on its call list. In addition to that, it's also got a GPS, and you can track the person who's wearing it, and you can also set up geofencing alerts so that you get a message if the person wanders outside the allowed range where you expect them to be. It also measures heart rate, and as I mentioned, it can actually make phone calls, so you can have up to 3 phone numbers on quick dial. There's a companion app for caregivers and family members, which you run on your smartphone, and it helps monitor the person who's wearing it. It can show you where they are, their heart rate, and other information. It's an interesting combination of features and addresses some of the needs that seniors who are going to have while they're trying to live at home and do so safely. My other two stories tonight are about wearable devices that can measure your blood pressure. Now, this is a big issue because blood pressure is one of those vital signs that your doctor or healthcare professional takes all the time. It's a way of diagnosing a number of different kinds of conditions and illnesses, and so it's an important figure for people to know. And the advantage of wearable devices is it makes it easier for you to monitor your own blood pressure throughout the day, because just taking a single shot every once in a while at your doctor's office isn't going to give you the full picture of what your blood pressure is doing. One of the traditional ways of taking your blood pressure is to have a pressure cuff that surrounds your arm or your wrist, and it squeezes and restricts the blood flow and then measures as the blood flow comes back. It measures the amount of pressure that the blood system has. Having one of these cuffs that compresses requires a lot of energy. They can be bulky, they're inconvenient. And so people have been looking for other ways of measuring your blood pressure without having to resort to this pressure cuff. Well, a bunch of researchers at Michigan State University have come up with one approach, which is kind of interesting, and it's based on the iPhone X. Now, this new phone from Apple has a special feature. All smartphones are touch sensitive. You can touch the screen and give it commands and move things around and so forth. But for the most part, all they know is whether or not there's a touch. One of the things about the iPhone X is that it is able to measure the amount of pressure in that touch. Okay, so if you're pushing harder, it can tell than if you're pushing lighter. For example, if you're doing a drawing program, you could get a wider brush by pressing harder and then a thinner brush by lifting up and pressing more lightly. Now, that feature can work the same kind of function that a pressure cuff does. By pushing harder or softer, you can restrict the flow of blood in your fingertip. They believe that they'll be able to capture that information by training the user to push gradually harder during the test period, and then this could give them the pressure information they need to come up with an accurate blood pressure reading. My own personal view is it may be a little difficult for users to create a reliable reading this way, but we'll find out as this product gets developed and goes through testing. Obviously, it needs to go through clinical testing before it could be a useful product, but the research team is working on that and hoping to get that accomplished soon. So it's an interesting approach to blood pressure in a mobile device, a smartphone that you'd be carrying around anyway. And if it works, it could make getting your blood pressure a whole lot easier. The real holy grail, though, for blood pressure in a wearable device is to not have to use pressure at all. A lot of people are exploring ways to do that optically, trying to shine lights and infer from various measurements whether the blood pressure is higher or lower, and maybe they'll even be able to tell just what the pressure is. But a lot of people are skeptical about whether optical systems will ever be able to adequately measure blood pressure. A bunch of people at University of California in San Diego have developed a new approach. It's kind of novel. They've created a smart patch, like a smart Band-Aid, that has digital electronics built into it. And with this, they believe that they'll be able to measure the blood pressure of a person. Not only will they measure the blood pressure, but they will be measuring central blood pressure, which is the arteries deeper in your body, as opposed to the measurements that we take closer to the skin routinely these days. Now, the way it works is they have tiny piezoelectric crystals embedded in this patch. The crystals are connected by flexible electronic connections. The whole device is like a Band-Aid, and those piezoelectric crystals actually are transducers for ultrasound. So this tiny little patch that's, again, the size of a Band-Aid can actually transmit ultrasound into your body and use that to measure your blood pressure. This is going to require a bunch more development before it can be brought to market. If this transducer arrangement on a flexible patch can work, all they need is some controller work and wireless data transmission, and we could have a patch that could continuously measure your blood pressure very accurately. And this could be very helpful for patients and healthy people alike. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Charles B. Wang, founder of Computer Associates and former New York Islanders owner, passed away this Sunday. He was born in Shanghai, China, and he moved to the United States with his family at the age of 8. Wang later founded Computer Associates Technologies and led several Long Island philanthropic efforts. Charles Wang, a founder of CA Technologies, poured his vast wealth into philanthropic pursuits on Long Island and around the world, and to efforts to keep the islanders on Long Island, and he passed away Sunday at the age of 74. The cause was lung cancer. National Hockey League Commissioner Gary Bettman, in a statement issued Sunday, said Wang's commitment to and passion for his beloved Islanders was matched by his dedication to and support for the Long Island community. He credited Wang as being the driving force behind efforts to promote hockey in China and video streaming the league. He started the company with Queens College classmate Russell Arts and grew CA to prominence with over 20,000 employees at its peak. With the wealth he earned from CA, Wang would provide $52 million for a sleek cultural center on the Stony Brook University campus to celebrate the links between Asian and American culture. Wang was born in China and came to the United States as a child in 1952. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are the biggest shopping days of the year, and they're just around the corner. The official event occurs on the day after Thanksgiving Day. Black Friday this year starts November the 23rd. Cyber Monday is November the 26th. Last year, Black Friday deals lasted for around 3 weeks. It is predicted for this year, Black Friday-related deals to last the whole month of November. Most customers use this sales period to pick up Christmas gifts for others and, of course, themselves. Early or pre-Black Friday deals begin with the day after Halloween. However, don't be fooled and think the best deals of the year are limited to Black Friday and Cyber Monday, because they aren't. Soon you will be receiving pre-Black Friday specials, and the impulse to buy rises to buy a particular product for fear that the low price will not be available later. We are regularly bombarded with blockbuster deals, super coupon deals, overstock markdowns, hottest deals, deal of the day, clickbuster deals, and probably many more adjectives for products sold online. Before buying anything online, use these two tools to make sure you're getting a good deal. How does one know what is a true discount of a sales item? The product may actually be more expensive than the regular sales price. Thankfully, there are tried and true ways to ensure you're getting a good deal. The first application is a price tracking tool. It's www.camelcamelcamel.com. And the second is a user reviews analyzer, fakespot.com. That's fakespot.com. I spoke about this a few weeks ago, but I thought I'd mention it again because with Black Friday, these will be very useful tools. The first is pretty straightforward. CamelCamelCamel.com is one of many product price trackers floating around the web, but it has been popular and reliable for the better part of a decade. To use it, simply copy and paste the URL of whatever item you're considering into the search bar at the top. The tool will then bring up a chart of how that item's price has fluctuated over time. You can just key in the product name and it will display a list of vendors offering the product at various prices. If you were to click on the first selection, the website displays a chart of the overall purchase price from product introduction to the current date. I just looked at the purchase price for the past 6 months or since the beginning of the year. It came as no surprise that purchase price for many of the electronic items have been raised right after Labor Day. I anticipate the prices will drop back down to July-August prices for Black Friday. I call that smart marketing 101. Fakespot offers a new way of filtering product reviews, allowing you to find what actual people are saying about the products. The proprietary technology analyzes millions of reviews and looks for suspicious patterns and discrepancies. It will then take out the reviews that seem too good to be true, so you can make an unbiased, reliable purchase. All you need is a URL of the product in question, which you copy and paste into the site, and FakeSpot will then scan and analyze information from both the review itself and the person who created the review. FakeSpot will then give it a grade ranging from A to F. A means 90 to 100% of the reviews and the reviews are reliable. And F means only 44% or less of the information is reliable. It will also give you a company grade, which takes the average of all product reviews. When analyzing product reviews, FakeSpot takes a look at certain credentials from the reviewer, from the review itself, and from the reviewer it looks to see if it is a verified purchase. And if the dates and content correlate, it also takes into account frequency and purchase dates. as well as various purchasing patterns. On the review front, it analyzes the writing style and spelling correlation and looks to see whether the dates and content correlate. Before Black Friday, really think about what you need. If there is a particular product you have in mind, try to be able to at least touch and feel the product first. Reference reviews from known sources is most important. Don't just look at the product. Try to put it through its paces. If it's clothing, try to find a size that really matches you. The same clothing size varies in size with different brand labels of clothes and shoes. Don't just look at a computer system. Determine the cost of disposable support items such as ink and toner cartridges. Analyze the total cost of operation. In the case of an inkjet printer or multifunction printer, what is the cost to print a color page as well as the cost for a black and white page? Is the supply readily available locally when you need to replenish the ink cartridges? Printers do not come with cables. If you have a Chromebook, not all printers can be used. Read carefully the specifications. Some reviewers complain what they bought was missing certain desirable features. Check the specs to make sure it meets all your minimum requirements. Don't buy it if it's missing features you must have. It is fair to say that if you bought it blind, you have no one to blame but yourself. This all goes some way for helping you avoid those impulse buys, which can be easy to do when Black Friday fever takes hold. While it might not be quite the same headline saving, it is better to get something to suit your needs rather than buying a product just because it's heavily discounted. It goes without saying, but make sure you hold onto the receipts just in case you're not entirely happy with your purchase. Make sure to take a look at the refund policy of the website before buying on Black Friday, especially if it is not free returns, as sending it back can be pricey. Look for dealers offering longer warranties for extra peace of mind. Also, make sure your purchased product isn't a gray import. What's a gray import, you ask? Gray imports are items that have been legally imported through channels other than the manufacturer's official distribution system. This can mean you can save even more cash, but be prepared to not get support when you have a problem or need to send it for repair. It won't have a U.S. warranty, so you won't be able to return it to the manufacturer in the United States. For the sake of saving a few extra dollars, and if that's all it is, it's not worth the risk. If you're buying electronics, read the specifications carefully. Read the fine print on returns and warranty. Most of the time, saving money is more about knowing what to buy. Being a smart shopper is by knowing the price history of the product and read the reviews, but be on the alert for fake reviews. Caveat emptor. Charles B. Wang, founder of Computer Associates and former New York Islanders owner, passed away this Sunday. He was born in Shanghai, China, and he moved to the United States with his family at the age of 8. Wang later founded Computer Associates Technologies and led several Long Island philanthropic efforts. Charles Wang, a founder of CA Technologies, poured his vast wealth into philanthropic pursuits on Long Island and around the world, and to efforts to keep the islanders on Long Island, and he passed away Sunday at the age of 74. The cause was lung cancer. Wang saw successes and setbacks in the fast-moving computer technology industry of the late 20th century and the financially fraught world of professional sport franchises in the early 21st century. He suffered the frustrations found in the Long Island politics and gave back to society by donating millions to child health charities and higher education. National Hockey League Commissioner Gary Bettman, in a statement issued Sunday, said Wang's commitment to and passion for his beloved Islanders was matched by his dedication to and support for the Long Island community. He credited Wang as being the driving force behind efforts to promote hockey in China and video streaming the league. He started the company with Queens College classmate Russell Arts and grew CA to prominence with over 20,000 employees at its peak. With the wealth he earned from CA, Wang would provide $52 million for a sleek cultural center on the Stony Brook University campus to celebrate the links between Asian and American culture. Wang was born in China and came to the United States as a child in 1952.
Hey, are you feeling miserly or not miserly? If you think you'd enjoy a more energy miserly house, you can't be miserly in the investment you'll have to make in better windows. But you can be slow and steady. Let's get the scary part out of the way. I'll start with a little sticker shock before I give you a less thorny route through this briar patch. Steady yourself. For a typical single-family residence with square footage in the mid-2000s, replacing all the windows with basic thermal panes and vinyl frames, cheapest option out there, might cost $3,500 and reduce your heating and cooling energy costs by 10 to 20%. Top-grade thermal windows there might cost $12,000 and bring energy cost savings of 35%. $3,500 at the low end, $12,000 or more to go high-end, with, of course, a lot of choices in the middle, and there are even some options that can cost still more. So go ahead, have a whiff of the smelling salts, and let's get you into a place where you can deal with less money at once and take a long time or do some less expensive things, or maybe you don't need to do anything. Ignoring things like rain and snow, consider what your house would be like if you didn't have any windows at all. Wait, I'd better rephrase that. Imagine what it would be like if you only had holes in the walls with nothing in them. Air would flow freely in both directions. Yeah, I know what some of you are thinking. Yeah, so would birds and wildlife and bugs and burglars. But let's stick with energy and comfort, okay? How many days a year is that airflow going to be perfectly comfortable? You know, not too hot, not too cold, not too dry, not too humid. A few days anyway, but far from all. Most of the time, you'll want to have something cover that hole. Probably be good if it's something that lets some light in. That's part of one of the energy miserliness principles we often address. Sealing the envelope, meaning not providing places in the shell of the house where heat can enter or escape beyond our control. So in sealing the envelope of a house, the total structural surface area of all the windows and glass doors, add those up, they're second only to the roof area. Collectively, they're important. But individually, well, they're still important, but less so. And in a few minutes, I'll explain how to take advantage of that. I'm about to explain what it is about good windows that makes a difference, and I encourage you to interpret the words leaking energy into the more painful experience of leaking money. I'm not here to sell you anything. On the contrary, I may end up slowing down your urge to buy anything, and that may be a good place to start. You may not need to do anything at all with your windows or glass doors. They may be fine. They may be performing as well as anything you could bring in to replace them. It's hard to tell just by looking, but it's not impossible. Obviously, you know, if you see curtains billow when the windows are closed, you have a major air leak in the window or in its frame or in the walls surrounding the frame. That's something you can look for. If you only have a single pane of glass, not double pane or triple pane, if you only have a single pane of glass, sometimes it's really hard to tell. You have to look very carefully to see the difference. That's a window you can significantly improve. If it's cold out, and you see condensation on the indoor side of a window, well, it's lost its integrity and it's come unsealed. You'll want to change it out. You can also feel differences if you have one or more rooms that are less comfortable than others. Well, it's reasonable to suspect windows is why that's happening. Do you know what goes into making a window these days? We should probably get into that, starting with the part you see through, which is called the glass package. Glazing, that's an uppity way to say glass. Glazing sandwiches a pocket of gas, and that stack of glass is sealed at its edges on all four sides. Got it? It's a sandwich. It's glass and glass on the outside, gas on the inside. The quality of that edge seal, the materials used to form the seal, and the nature of the window frame that surround the glass package all have a lot to do with how long it will remain effective. You can buy triple pane windows, more of a Dagwood sandwich of, ready? Glass. Don't repeat that, you'll go crazy. They're good at reducing noise a little more, good at cutting back a little more on thermal leakage, but they're more than a little more expensive and you probably don't need them. The gas between the panes is usually argon gas, one of the noble gases, so it's very stable. But there are other noble gas options available, like xenon or krypton. And either one of those, again, will insulate a little tiny bit better, but probably not worth the jack up in price, the extra money that they have to charge, because those gases are harder to harvest out of the atmosphere. You can get glass with films applied to cut down how much ultraviolet light gets into the house. UV does cause a lot of color fading, furniture and carpets, wall treatments, and it may cause some greenhouse heating. But those films also cut down on illumination, and you might be happier using window treatments to achieve the UV blocking, shutters, you know, shades, any of that stuff. Ultimately, and this is important to remember, ultimately the overall thickness of the entire glass package, the thickness from the outside surface of the outside pane to the inside surface of the inside pane, is a good indicator of the likely effectiveness of a thermal window. It's not so much because of the glass, but because of how much gas is between the panes. Pay attention to it. That thickness is one place where bargain window makers may try to short you. Remember, the glass package isn't the whole package. How good is your window frame? Is it truly square? Is there any room for the panes to wobble within them? For that matter, are they designed to open but got painted shut? And one more very significant question. When it's very cold or very warm outside that window, can you feel that when you touch the frame from the inside of the house? Many frames conduct thermal energy from the outside to the inside, from the inside to the outside, because of the way they're built. And now, wait a minute, that's not quite accurate. It's because of the way they're not built. Good frames interrupt that heat and cold escape path using thermal breaks. That's layers or buffers of insulation that convert the outside frame and the inside frame into thermally separate entities. They're mechanically unitized, but they're thermally separated. Those are thermal breaks. Look for that. If your window frames pass all these tests, but you still need to replace the glass package, there may be one less costly alternative for you, but it's one more thing to check out first, and let me start with a mental image. If you could take a window in its frame and hang it from a really strong clothesline, got that image? How effective would it be at keeping the inside any warmer or cooler than the outside, right? Zippity zilch, right? It's just letting the air flow around it. It's not blocking anything. Some of the same faults that can occur in window frames can also occur in the immediately surrounding walls in which they're mounted. It could be rot, warping, deterioration. That's going to require some carpentry, and while you're at it, it's also a good idea to improve the insulation in those parts of the walls. So let's say that the walls are okay, but the frames aren't. Frames can be confusing. There are almost too many kinds. Vinyl, which is generally the least expensive, all wood, fiberglass, wood clad in vinyl, aluminum, composite polymer, and you know, that's not all. There's a lot of choices. What are the trade-offs? Strength, cost, maintenance needs, and continued air stop integrity for the long term. My personal opinion is get the frames and the windows from the same source. I'm also of the opinion that I shouldn't try to tackle this job myself. A do-it-yourselfer, I do it sometimes, a do-it-yourselfer may like to save labor costs, but the first time I drop and break a window could completely cost justify having a pro do the work. Now, if your walls are good and your frames are good, but your panes and glass package not so much so, there's another option for you, one you might not consider for every window, but you could. It's called insert frames. An insert frame is a complete glass package surrounded by a bordering rim, half an inch or so, maybe half an inch to an inch wide, and it goes in where the old glass had been. Yeah, you lose a little bit of clear window area, that border, but where one really good quality full frame window might cost $1,200 to $1,500 installed, an insert would cost several hundred dollars less. It's your choice, but you might want to ask about it or look into it. So now you have a better grasp on the window's glass package and the frame around it and the wall around that and about how attention to all three can keep that hole in the wall from being an energy leak. And remember, money leak for your house. But I still haven't addressed the sticker shock of replacing everything, everywhere, all across your house. And when we get to the end, here's a little treat for you. I'll be giving you a surprising tip on something you can do for free to make any window a better energy saver. Now, if you're as instrumentation-bound as I tend to be, geeks are geeks, right? You'll go from room to room with a notepad and a thermometer, and when the temperature outside isn't pleasant, you'll make a log entry for each window, writing down which room it's in, the window position, and the temperature of the room just inside the window. You can even turn your back on the window so you won't be greenhouse heating the thermometer. You want to take those measurements twice, once with the sun in the east, once with the sun in the west. You can take notice of which rooms are normally vacant and which are in use. And when you examine those numbers, well, that can help you decide which rooms to address first. Upgrading windows one room at a time isn't a bad way to approach the need and doesn't make you pay to retrofit the whole house at once. See, I told you you could take baby steps with this. Or with the same end result in mind, you can skip the thermometer and just check with everybody in the house to figure out which room is the most uncomfortable and do that room first. I can take either side in arguing the validity of these two approaches. The point is to take those baby steps in depleting your available funds. I also promised you, and here's the treat, a little something you can do for free. Something I learned from a vice president at one of the major window brands. You know that little latch between the top frame of a window and the bottom frame, or between the edge of the window and the wall? Closing that latch, locking that window, makes it 3 times more energy efficient than one that isn't latched. I like that because it's an excellent and dramatic example of how important blocking airflow can be in sealing the envelope of a house to make it more energy miserly. And remember, improving the energy usage, cutting down on energy waste, gives your HVAC system less work to do, and less loading means less wear and tear, and less wear and tear means months to years longer before you face major repair or replacement costs. Ka-ching, cha-ching. As you're well aware, once those big repair needs hit, it's too late to back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation on updated tips for staying safe online. Thursday, October the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Computer Lab at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC User Group will have a presentation on Computational Knowledge Engine Wolfram Alpha. Meeting time is Thursday, November the 1st at 7 p.m. They meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets on Friday, November the 2nd at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, November the 6th, 7:30 p.m., and they meet at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, November the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 411 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, November the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology in Old Westbury Campus, out in Old Westbury, New York. Computer Learning Center at Ewing, they have a presentation on new technology toys for the holidays. Tuesday, December the 4th. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m., and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey.
I hope we'll be seeing you at one of these club meetings.
Our website is pcradioshow.org.
We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, and, well, don't forget to back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.